the big, tight, strong army bond that you've built, you know, I could probably call up, 50 different people that I haven't spoken to in 2 or 3 years, and they would, at the drop of a hat, help me out and support somebody else or help me directly, just like I would for somebody else. So you have this unique relationship where you don't necessarily have to talk to them every day or stay really close with them, but you've become so close through that your time with them in a unit that you've been with them that you'd do just about anything for anybody you've ever served with.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Ben Cavanaugh, one of our two guests today on our Zoom version of Tartan Talks. Lieutenant Colonel Cavanaugh joins us with Major Andrew Matt, both of whom are employees here at Edinburgh University. We talk a little bit about their lifelong commitment to the United States military, whether it's serving overseas, training the next generation of soldiers, or just plain out serving your country. These two strong Army veterans share their experience about meeting the cadets and the soldiers they served with, what it's like having mutual respect for leadership and for the commanders and drill sergeants that they face in the military, and what a career of service has led them to today. So here's another Zoom version of Tartan Talks, where we share stories of these two Edinburgh University Fighting Scots. Thanks for joining us here on Tartan Talks. This is Tartan Talks, a podcast from Edinburgh University. I'm your host, Christopher LaFuria. Each month, we'll take a look at individuals who make Edinburgh an exciting, diverse, and profound place to discover your passions. All right, thank you for joining us today on Tartan Talks. We have two Edinburgh University staff members who have between them nearly 30 years of active military service. We have Lieutenant Colonel Ben Cavanaugh, who is the commander of the Edinburgh University ROTC Fighting Scots Battalion. And we have Andrew Matt, Major Andrew Matt, who is the Title IX coordinator here at Edinburgh University. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us today on Tartan Talks.
Thanks for having us.
All right, today we are going to talk about careers in the military. We're going to talk about service to the United States and what it means to put on the uniform, to help develop leaders, and to help serve our neighbors, our brothers and sisters, and our families. So let's start off with one question I've been very curious about. My brother Matt LaFuria, he's a staff sergeant in the Army before he retired. I was chatting to him about what it was like with his military service. And I was like, I'm going to be interviewing two military veterans, and there are all sorts of questions you can ask, from what was boot camp like to what was it like battling overseas or being on ships, being in the desert. And I was like, Matt, what is one thing that you are most curious about when talking to other veterans? And the question he asked, and the question I'm going to pass along to you guys right now, is what was your aha moment? What was the moment when you thought, I have made my decision to be part of the military? Lieutenant Colonel Cavanaugh, you are active in the military. You're a ROTC commander. And then Andrew, you are active in the Army Reserves. So what has been your... Ben, let's start with you. What was your aha moment for military experience?
So this is going to sound weird, Chris. I'm not sure I've had it yet.
Is that right?
And what I mean by that is I was never totally sure, when the desire to join the Army was. As long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be, an Army guy. A little kid running around in camouflage pants in the neighborhood, shooting Nerf guns. I always knew I wanted to be a soldier. As I grew up and I learned about ROTC and what it was, I was like, wow, this is a really great opportunity for me to travel and then still be in the Army and I can go see the world. As I got into the Army and had a few jobs, I was coming up on my 4-year mark, which is sort of your stay in, get out, that's your initial commitment you have. And so I told my wife at the time, I said, well, I'm going to keep serving until I find a job that I don't like or I don't think I like the Army anymore. And I'm still in, 18 years later. I've had great jobs. I worked with awesome people. And I've really just loved what the Army has been able to provide to my family. I feel like I have a sense of purpose and that I've been, doing a great job, and I love it. So I have not had that aha moment of why I'm still here. I just I've never reached that deal with myself of, all right, Ben, you're not good at it anymore, or the Army doesn't like you, or you don't like it, get out. So I'm still here and love it. loving it.
So either you haven't had your aha moment, or your career and life is just one continuous aha moment. You're still in that moment right now.
I'm still in it, Chris.
So, Andrew, let's go over to you. You've taken on a couple different roles. You've been head of our Veteran Success Center here at Edinburgh for a couple years. You're now working with Title IX, and you are an active Army Reserve member. What was your aha moment, or just like Ben, has yours yet to be seen?
So, a lot like Colonel Kavanaugh, I kind of started the same way. I've always kind of had an interest in being in the military. My grandpa, he was in the Navy. He was actually at Pearl Harbor when the Japanese attacked.
Wow.
So that was always kind of this thing that was sitting in our background as a family. My stepdad, he was also in the United States Army. He was a field artilleryman, which is kind of funny because eventually that's where my career kind of headed.
Interesting.
I became a field artilleryman. For the aha moment to, hey, I'm joining the military, a lot like Colonel Kavanaugh, just kind of, it never really happened. I did a bunch of things. I actually went about my career in a kind of opposite way most people do. I completed college, I got my law degree, got my master's, actually was teaching English at college, and then decided to end up joining the Army, which is a lot different than what a lot of people do. And if there was an aha moment that I ever actually had, it was kind of more the aha moment to join the reserves.
Interesting.
So after doing my initial commitment, which Colonel Kavanaugh talked about, I got to the end of my 4 years and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I left active duty after, 4 years on active duty. And then I was sitting in my job and I realized how much I missed being in the military. Being part of, the Army life and being an Army leader. And I found a good unit, switched over from field artillery over to psychological operations, and that's been the last basically 6 years.
Yeah.
Excuse me, has been, doing psychological operations work and working with soldiers and, just trying to figure out how best to be an Army and best be a leader and help people out.
Very interesting. So, and we'll get to this during our conversation, talk about your careers and where it's taken you, whether it's across the country or internationally. But let's go back to when you started. What motivated you to join the Army or to join the military? I know, Ben, you talked about how you were a little kid dressing up in camo and always wanted to be a soldier. But when did that, what moment or what motivated you initially to jump into a career in the military?
Mentors. So I did, my neighbor growing up, he was an officer in the Army. He was an enlisted soldier in Vietnam, and then he was an officer. And I didn't know the difference between an officer and enlisted at that point. But he would just come and just tell me, stories about where he had done training and things that he had done, and really just let me know that, there is a life outside of the small town I grew up in, and go after it. And he was like, just go do this, try this thing out for 4 years, get out when you're done, and you're going to have more experience than you'll ever have if you never leave your hometown. And in high school, I really took that to heart. He had moved away, and one of my high school instructors was also a Vietnam veteran. So that teacher, he would tell me stories about what he did in the Army and sort of kept that fire alive in me. So, from there, I was like, I'm going to go to West Point and join the Army, or I'm going to go figure out what this ROTC thing is at a college. And I ended up doing ROTC at Penn State, and best decision I could have ever made.
Very cool. That's interesting. So you, I know, Andrew, you were saying how you joined the military after your educational career, but it was kind of in the middle for you, Ben, how you got that, you got your college degree while learning about the military, while being involved in ROTC. So it's interesting kind of where you get your start in the military experience. So Andrew, let's go over to you. What was your main motivation for joining?
Like I said, my family was a big portion of it. But when I finally actually did decide to join, I'd been reading a lot. And, you get the whole cool guy factor, so to speak, where you see things in movies and you read a lot of books and you see all these neat things that are going on. And I was reading about all these things, and civil affairs kept sticking out to me as like this cool, like special operations side thing, you know, and that was kind of where I was thinking of going. And then it's kind of odd, really, to think that, you know, now I'm in KPOC, Civil Affairs and Cycle Operations Command, on the other side of things in psychological operations. So I kind of met the goal that I had, the motivating factor, just in a kind of weird roundabout way.
Yeah. Interesting. One of the things I've always been curious about, and you see this in, you know, ROTC commercials, you see it in Army commercials and Army promotions, you see those soldiers, you know, getting dirty in the field. You see them jumping over walls, doing all sorts of monkey bars and running. Take us to basic training. Take us to boot camp. What was that like? Honestly, like that's something that you always see. You see in movies and you hear people talk about. But I want to know what it's physically like. Is it what? How demanding is it? And, you know, what was your experience like? Andrew, let's start with you.
So I think the best story to start with boot camp for me is, so I talked about how I did a lot of research. I read a lot. So I get through, you know, talking to my recruiters and going through the process, and they give me my papers and they say, you're going down to North Carolina and you're going to Fort Jackson, and that's where you're going to do basic training. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. And then we go to MEPS, which is military entrance processing. And I'm at the facility, and I get sworn in, and then they hand me my actual orders, and they say, congratulations, you're going to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And I'm like, where is Fort Sill, Oklahoma? I had no clue. They're like, you're going to this one place. So I read up on it. I was getting all prepared. And they're like, you're going someplace totally different. And then I said, you know, my dad was in field artillery. Fort Sill is the home of field artillery. And my dad's like, oh, I was there back in the 50s. And I'm like, so what's it like? He's like, good luck. I'm like, wonderful. I get on a plane, and you know, I've been on planes before, but this is my first time ever going to Oklahoma. We get off, we take off. It's October. It was October 10th actually, because it was right after my dad's birthday. And get on the plane, and a few hours later, we're about to touch down in Oklahoma. And all you can see out the windows is nothing. It's just gray clouds because it was so foggy. Plane tried to touch down, had to go back up, comes back down. And then we get off the plane. We go find, you know, the one bag that we brought with us. And they're there waiting for us. They collect us all up. We get on a bus. And at that point, it was like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. So we're driving from Oklahoma City down to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is about a two-hour drive. And so we get there at midnight. It's like semi-raining, really foggy, just absolutely miserable. And they yell at us, and they get us all off the bus. And then it was just insanity as we're all running around like chickens with our head cut off, trying to figure out what they want us to do, what's the next thing we're supposed to do. All right. They were relatively calm and nice through the paperwork process.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot. It's very standardized. Everything's very set. And that's just the administrative process. You know, the first few weeks are always just administrative, getting you all set. And then after that, then you actually go what's called across the tracks. So at Fort Sill, the administrative unit that in-processes you is on one side of the railroad tracks to the north. And then the actual basic training side is to the south. So you literally go across the tracks. And once you get across the tracks, then everything changes from this, like, okay, you're kind of doing things, to now you're really seriously doing stuff. Because you wake up every morning and you're doing physical exercise. You know, you're doing your physical fitness. You're either running or you're doing push-ups, or they've got some sort of CrossFit exercise they want you to do. And you're just working all day long. Like from the moment you wake up, you are exercising, eating, or doing whatever work they had planned for you, whether that's, hey, we're going out to the range, or, hey, we're going to be doing this training, so we need 10 soldiers who are going to help us to actually set things up. One of the biggest things that's always funny is you've got all your images from television and movies of what drill sergeants are like, And usually the second day is when they kind of hit you. And that's what they did with us. It was really goofy because we're all asleep. Some of us had gotten up a little bit early because we knew, okay, hey, this is when the time is going to hit. You know, we don't always sleep all that great. And I'm up a little bit early, and the first thing I hear is, "Bat, they did it again. That is a battle fight." And we're like, "How could we do it again? This is day two. how did we do something again?" And the drill sergeant just comes in and just starts throwing garbage out of the garbage can because they don't tell you everything, but they didn't tell us they wanted us to clean out the garbage cans in the evening. And nobody had done that. So they were unhappy with us because of that. But over time, you kind of build a relationship with the drill sergeants. You got to understand that you've got to be respectful. But, you know, they try to, you know, help you and mentor you and coach you. So, you know, you've got that fearful element of, oh, my God, we're going to be doing this, and it's going to be this, and it's going to be hard. But at the same time, you know, they're there because they want you to succeed. You know, it's their job to train you and mentor you and get you through the process. And as you're doing the different events, you know, when you start off, you know, you might not do that great on the PT test because, you know, you haven't practiced a lot at home. But then when you actually pass it, you know, as you're coming towards the end of basic training, you know, that's a big chip on your shoulder. You're really happy about that. When you do your first weapons qualification and you actually shoot, whether it's marksman or, you know, sharpshooter or expert, you know, you're really proud of that achievement. And then the biggest thing is, you know, completing the ruck march. And Oklahoma is kind of neat because it's warm during the day and then freezing cold at night, especially in winter. And that was when I did, mine was October into the winter. And it was pretty crazy doing the 12-mile ruck march at the end of it and it being freezing cold.
Yeah, I'm sure.
We're all just kind of, yeah, and we're just trying to get it done. And we're like, okay, we just want to be done. And it's a really big moment when you actually do complete that ruck march. And, you know, now all of a sudden they're like, well, now you guys are soldiers. You're not just civilians who want to be soldiers, people who are in the training. So it's a pretty exciting experience.
It's interesting. And also during that process, when your drill sergeant is, you know, being strict with you, it also builds that loyalty. Also, you have respect for them, and I'm sure they have respect for you as long as you're giving your all, you're trying your hardest and you're just doing your best. So I imagine you have some lasting stories that might not be, you know, your favorite, but you also have some where people are legitimately proud of you and they wanted to see you succeed. And I think that's kind of what a lot of this is all about.
Yeah, that's the really big point.
Yeah. Ben, let's go over to you. Take us to boot camp. Take us to PT. What was it like for you?
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, after listening to Andrew, I don't feel like I'm in the Army. So, I mean, it's kind of unique, you know, the route that Andrew took, you know, going through, you know, basic training and then did the officer candidate school to become an Army officer. You know, so he does go through that crucible event of boot camp. But if a student who wants to be in the Army and be an officer and they do ROTC, you know, we don't necessarily have that same, I guess, crucible event that we go through. We do have the basic officer's leader course, which is your introduction to your branch. But the closest thing that we do is, you know, we have the summer training that we go to for 5 weeks, and essentially we're tested on all the same things that Andrew described, but in a different way. What they're looking for is like the leadership attributes, or how can you get a team together to accomplish a task or a mission. You know, that could be a tactical exercise. It could be as simple as, you know, when we do the same in processing with cadets at summer training, you know, you're moving into barracks, you're getting beds made, you're assigning rooms, turning in rosters, figuring out how to do the laundry. And they're going to pick, you know, cadet leaders every day. And you're assessed on, okay, I have the most boring job in the world of moving in and getting the laundry set up and the rotation for, you know, fire guard. But they don't care. That's your job. You have to. You're put in charge. You're going to take charge. You're going to do the. You're going to be the best laundry planner there is that day, and then you're going to turn over the reins to leadership the next day, and somebody else is going to lead. But we also do have to do the weapons qualification. We'll throw a grenade. We'll have to go rappelling and show the confidence that we have in our equipment, and that we're not afraid to go down a rappelling wall or go through a high ropes course, pass the swimming test. So we'll do that over a 5-week period between our junior and senior year. But everything that we do from day one of ROTC as a freshman until we go to that summer training, you know, is geared toward that test. You know, so, you know, every day, you know, on Edinburgh's campus, you're gonna see cadets out there doing PT and running.
That's usually when I'm in my office drinking my coffee. I'll look outside and I'll see a battalion of 20 odd cadets just running before it's even light out there. It's impressive what you do at the earliest moments of the day.
You motivate me every morning, Chris. I run by your window and I see the light. I'm like, man, he's already getting after me. I'm out here running with these young kids, dying.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting point too. As a ROTC battalion commander, after your time, you know, as a student and young military cadet, you're still active in this. You're still doing the work. You're still in it. And I guess like having a good experience early on and learning that discipline and that loyalty kind of, you know, helps you get motivated for that when you're training the next generation.
Oh, definitely.
I guess the next thing I think about when you consider a career in the military is the travel. We're not talking about, you know, leisurely traveling on vacation. We're talking about traveling overseas to try and solve some sort of conflict. Talk about what place that you traveled to or what station you had that had the most impact on your life, whether it was Andrew spending the cold winters in Fort Drum or Ben, if you travel into Europe. Just for example, let's start with Ben. Talk about the location that you were headed that had the most impact on your career.
It's hard to say that there's ever one, but I would say, so my last duty station, I was fortunate, one of the few fortunate people in the Army to get, you know, the one of the glory duty stations, and I was stationed in Italy for 3 years. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. You know, being in northern Italy, an hour's train ride from, you know, from Venice. So, yes, people hate me if I tell them, yeah, I went to Venice and it was only for lunch because my wife and I, that's what we wanted to do. But out of that job, I was part of U.S. Army Africa and I got to travel down to Africa.
Oh, interesting.
And so I was, when I arrived into Army Africa, that's right when the Ebola crisis kicked off down in Liberia. So the entire, you know, chain of command from the, you know, the general down to the newest sergeant that was assigned to that duty station, you know, everybody had their eyes on the Ebola problem. And then me and 12 other special little people, we were picked to continue to drive on with a mission of, you know, how do we posture, you know, soldiers and Marines in Africa if something goes wrong. So while everybody's solving, you know, the medical problem of Ebola, or, you know, how do we build enough, you know, stations and testing sites, you know, similar to what we're doing now for COVID, you know, they were doing that in Liberia for that. So then there's, like I said, there's just 12 of us working on this other problem of how do we find property in Africa so the Marines can go there, you know, if an embassy had a problem, they would need a plot of land for Marines to pitch tents and be in a safe, secure area. And that was our job. So we were figuring that out. But, you know, we're doing it from, you know, 1,000 miles away. We're just planning this from Italy with small teams that were down on the continent doing it. And then I actually got to go down to Cameroon and build one of these.
Wow.
So as an Army engineer, they said, Ben, you're the engineer, you're going down there. And again, it was, I think, like 17 or 20 of us that went down there. And then we had a company of Marines that went down there with us as the security. And so they put us on an international airfield, which was split in half. Half of it was the, you know, the international airfield for Garoa, and the other half was an Air Force base.
Wow.
So the Air Force base gave us, you know, a little corner of their property. And essentially we built, you know, one of these forward staging bases for Marines. You know, it had 3 buildings on it when we got there. And when we left, it still had 3 buildings, but it had a boatload of tents and secured areas and bunkers and, you know, all this stuff. So in the event something went horribly wrong around that area, then we could, you know, leverage Marines to go there and then go to the embassy and provide embassy relief. And, you know, while we were there, we were actually conducting, you know, missions from there, of flying drones from there to take pictures of the Zambezi forest and look for things.
Is that where you got your obsession with flying drones?
That could that's where it all started.
Ben Cavanaugh, he is great at capturing drone footage, so he's always surveilling campus and getting that great photo. So it seems like you almost got your start with that in the Army. So when you were done building those tents and those areas, was it more of, you know, I can't believe we just got that finished, or was it more a sense of like, that was tiring, that was a project?
It was just a sense of accomplishment of, you know, you can look at either the satellite imagery or imagery from when we first got there, and you're just like, I can't believe how much we accomplished in 3 months.
That's crazy.
And holy cow, I just want to go home and sleep for 2 weeks. I am beat.
Right.
And, you know, it's like every day you're doing something. And not to say that you work. And Andrew, you can tell me if you think I'm lying, but I think he'll back me up. I mean, yeah, you work really hard when you go out and do some of these missions. But you really do strive to, like, find some release or something to do just to break up the normal. So one of the other majors that I was deployed with, Matt, he and I, we would try to just coordinate running races with our Air Force counterparts.
Oh, wow. You know,
the Air Force local nationals. So when we were there for Thanksgiving, we did a turkey trot or gobble wobble, whatever you want to call it, down the runway with the Air Force guys. We did another one for Christmas and New Year's. We invited the locals, you know, the colonel who was in charge of that base. You know, we had a pig cookout for New Year's Eve. You know, so we try to do some of these, you know, morale boosting things too with the for the soldiers, and then that's how you really get to meet and get to know the
definitely,
you know, your counterparts from that other nation that you're working with.
Very interesting. Andrew, over to you. Talk about an experience, a place you traveled to that impacted your life.
So, you know, my experience is nowhere near as cool as Cavanaugh.
Yeah, pig roast, traveling to Africa.
Andrew, I don't know, though. You did basic training. I didn't get through that.
I'll take heavily over basic training. But, you know, for me and, you know, a lot of the people that I've talked to, I really think the first duty station, which for me was Fort Drum, New York, it really has an effect on you, because the culture of that first duty station and the unit that you're with, the history of that unit, what you think of them, what jobs you have, just kind of give you an idea. As a young field artillery lieutenant coming into the job, you basically have three positions that you're kind of expected to do, or that you're going to have. Field fire support officer, FSO, fire direction officer, FDO, and then platoon leader, where you're actually in charge of a gun line. And, you know, you do your jobs, and, you know, when you're in the military, everything's kind of very, very set. You're going to do this job, you're going to do this job, you're going to do this job. And then if you do really good, you might be able to be an executive officer, or maybe an assistant operations officer or something. Then, hey, now you promote to captain. Now you can do this job, this job, this job. You're going to take command. And as you go about doing those things, that kind of helps to form your idea of what the military's like. And, you know, I had a lot of good times at Fort Drum. The soldiers are really the piece that really makes it fun and enjoyable. Everybody's got their own little personalities and what they do and how they think about being a soldier, and they've got their own little craziness. And you work with them, and it's the most enjoyable part, really.
You know,
there were times I would go out with my FSNCO, and we would go out, and we would just go out to, like, the furthest out range, just because he heard, hey, there's something out there. We found this old, like, radar installation in the back of Fort Drum.
Interesting.
That nobody really knew about. Yeah. Because he's like, hey, I heard about this circle out in the middle of nowhere. And I'm like, all right, let's go find it. So we told my commander that we were going out to do a recon on a range we were going to be at the next day. We did the recon, but then immediately after we went to this other place. and you do stuff like that, or, you know, you're out there and you've got downtime. Pro Cavanaugh was talking about doing races and stuff. You know, at times we would do some really goofy things, like some of our guys were good at what's called field craft, building things in the field. So our one guy, Tater, he built a chair out of just wood and duct tape that he had. And then they got really bored, so they went from building chairs to then building catapults.
Oh, jeez.
So it can get kind of crazy out there as you're, you know, trying to break up that tedium, as Colonel Kavanaugh said. You're trying to find new things to keep yourself interested. But, you know, you get the job done, and like he said, you're out there for a certain amount of time, and you've done your week in the field, or you've done your month in the field, and you come back, and you're really excited about things. When I moved over to being a budget officer at Tenth Mountain, there were a lot of points where I was really happy with my work there, because it was a lot about ensuring that things were being bought properly, that things were moving along. I was really happy because we were in the middle of sequestration, and I was able to get $600,000 more into the unit.
Awesome.
So that we could finish off the year. So that was kind of my big point.
You could build more catapults.
Yeah, so catapults are cheap. It's tape and wood.
It's tape and wood.
Yeah, 100 mile hour tape's the expensive part.
So it's interesting. In both of your last responses, you talked about Andrew. You mentioned your fellow soldier Tater, and Ben, you talked about, you know, having a pig roast with your fellow soldiers. Talk about the people that you met during your experience. Are there certain commanders or fellow soldiers or friends that you made that stood out, or was there someone special that you met as you were working? Somebody from a different country, or someone from a different battalion, or cadre. Let's talk about kind of like the relationships that you build in the Army. So Andrew, let's start with you. Talk about some of the friendships, some of the camaraderie that you have in the military.
As you know, Chris, you know, I got married last year.
Yes.
And at the wedding, actually, I had my old NCO, Sergeant Wells. He came up from Ohio. Sergeant Paul, Sergeant Houston, they all came up and enjoyed the wedding with me.
That's awesome.
And it's something that matters. Colonel Kavanaugh was there too, and he got to sit around and talk to some of the people I have reserved with. And, you know, you build serious relationships, you talk to them all the time. You know, and Colonel Kavanaugh can talk about being a commander and having a first sergeant. The NCO you have, that second in charge, the non-commissioned officer, you build a really close relationship with them, especially once you become a commander and you have your first sergeant. You know, you're, as a reservist, I'm on the phone with mine, you know, every week at least, if not more, you know, just discussing what's going on and, you know, what needs to be done and, you know, what work needs to be taken care of. So those guys are really important. And then, you know, if you want to talk about leadership, one of the funny things in the Army is how people bounce back and forth. And you see people all the time in different places. My old boss, my battalion commander, Colonel Bernabe, now General Bernabe, it's been kind of funny that he was my first battalion commander, and then I ran into him again at NTC as a brigade commander for a unit I was supporting. And then at JRTC, the Joint Readiness Training Center, ran into him twice there.
Wow.
And then this mission I was supposed to do in Europe, he's actually a commander over in Europe now, so I would have met him again.
Wow.
Then. So it's kind of one of those funny things that happens is, you know, you build relationships, but then it's what we call the small army, so we see people all the time.
Yeah. And these aren't just your coworkers, but they also become close friends. And to build a lasting friendship, to have people up here for your wedding, I mean, that's a higher level relationship that you can't just, that isn't something that's very like casual, very friendly. That's kind of a close relationship you build with somebody, and that's kind of a cool story. One thing I've noticed, and you can talk about the relationships you've built. I've noticed as the battalion commander, you do have a way of talking to your cadets with a very, you know, very strong leadership, but you also get to know them very well. I see you tell jokes, tell stories, but there's also a level of respect that they have for it. They're always calling you Lieutenant Colonel, they're calling you Sir. And that's kind of an interesting dynamic, because you do have to develop relationships with the people in your cadre, but also you have to get to know them as people as well. So talk a little bit about that aspect and also some of the special relationships that you've built.
Yeah, I think it's sort of going to tie into a little bit what Andrew said. You know, whether it's an NCO or a soldier that you've worked with, you know, during that role when you're working with them, whether you're their direct supervisor, or if you're, you know, in their chain of command, there's a certain, you know, there's a go, no-go criteria for things you can and can't do, or things, you know, how you can interact with them. So you're going to get a very professional relationship. You're also going to get to know them very well, so you know their strengths and weaknesses. And it's not to say that, you know, it's very lockstep and you don't know, you know, very many details, or you can't socialize with them, because you can, but you're going to get to know them and how they are a part of the mission. And then as all things happen in the Army, you know, people move on. In the job I'm in, I'm very fortunate, and I get to see all these great new lieutenants go out into the Army. So really it's, you know, why they're a student at Edinburgh, you know, it's, I have the professor military science hat that I wear with them, and I'm trying to lead them in the right direction to develop them. And then when they leave, you know, so when Cadet Hunter becomes Lieutenant Hunter, or, you know, this year old Cadet Linehart can go up and be Lieutenant Linehart, you know, I'm going to try to stay in touch with them, and just then I'm going to be like, hey, Lieutenant, how are things out there in the force? Can you come back and speak with some of the cadets at Edinburgh? Or if it's a, you know, an NCO that you've worked with, and you're going to have that, you know, one certain type of relationship with them, you know, while you're in the unit, and you're going to, they're going to farewell, and they're going to go off somewhere, you're going to be like, oh, you're at Fort Drum. I'm going to Fort Drum next. Hey, can you help me? Can you send me some information about house hunting? Or I have a friend who's going there. Can you mail them a map of New York and, you know, some information about it? And so you have a really unique relationship that you build with people, because, you know, you're going to, sometimes you'll live with them day in and day out for, you know, a year on deployment. The big, tight, strong Army bond that you've built, you know, I could probably call up, you know, 50 different people that I haven't spoken to in 2 or 3 years, and they would, at the drop of a hat, help me out and support somebody else or help me directly, just like I would for somebody else. So you have this unique relationship where you don't necessarily have to talk to them every day or stay really close with them, but you become so close through that, your time with them in a unit that you've been with them, that you know, you'd do just about anything for anybody you've ever served with, if they've deserved it. You know,
Almost like the Hollywood cliche goes with Band of Brothers. You become more than just coworkers and friends. There's almost a family relationship building, which is interesting to see. I mean, there's not too many, you know, professions or situations where you have that level of commitment to your coworkers. So that's always fascinating to hear stories about that.
And I mean, I'd say there's the big side of it is, you know, in the Army, you know, Andrew is a commander now. He's going to deal with soldier problems and soldier issues. But, you know, we genuinely do care about, you know, our job doesn't stop at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we want to know that we're going to give you a weekend safety brief, not because we have to, because we don't have to do those anymore in the Army, but we just want to make sure that the soldiers, cadets, or the other officers that we're in charge of know that we care, and we want them to know that, you know, here's some dumb things you can do on the weekend, and let's avoid them.
Yeah.
And we'll call each other on the weekend just to be like, you know, you know somebody's grandmother passed away. You know, I'm going to call them and just to see how they're doing on a Saturday.
Just to check in.
Just to check in.
Very interesting.
And I don't know any other professions or, I guess, jobs that would do that.
The next thing I want to ask about is your rank in the military. What, not necessarily your current rank. I know, Andrew, you're a major, and Lieutenant Colonel Kavanaugh, you're obviously a Lieutenant Colonel. What has been the rank or position in the military that has made you the most proud? So maybe it's a promotion that you worked really hard for, or one that you really think you deserved. What in your career has been the rank that you are most proud of? And let's start with Andrew.
Rank is kind of goofy because, you know, it's kind of a number. So you got 01, which is your second lieutenant, and, you know, I'm an 04 right now as a major. I guess rank-wise, you could say, you know, major, because I got it what's called below the zone, which means that I got it before I was supposed to.
Oh, interesting.
So I got it a year early. And there was a lot of work that went into it. Yeah, I had to make sure all my documents were in order, make sure that I had all my schooling done properly, try to get good assignments, get good reviews and evaluations. So our officer evaluations, so our OERs, make sure that I had good ones, make sure that, you know, it showed that I was developing as an officer. You know, and what I put into that was mostly just making sure that I'm doing the best that I can. You know, find me. One of my biggest things is always, and regardless of what you're doing and what job you have, always look for opportunities. You know, that don't just sit there and go, okay, well, you know, like looking at here, oh, I'm the Title IX coordinator. So when they need help over at Residence Life for helping out with move out and things, I don't need to do that. Well, no, I should be doing that. You know, I'm here to help the community and help the organization. I've always tried to do the same thing in the Army, where I look for opportunities to help others. What can I do to support the Army? Whether that's, you know, if Colonel Kavanaugh needs me to come over and talk about what it's like to be an Army reservist. You know, I've done that for ROTC in the past. For the military history course this year, I went over and did a discussion about what psychological operations and civil affairs and special operations is all about. And you can take that back and you talk about that to your commander and you say, hey, here's some of the stuff that I'm doing to introduce the Army to a wider population, to give people an idea of what SIOP's all about, so that, you know, maybe in the future as they get to the point where they might be captains and might be able to become, you know, psychological operations soldiers, they might take interest in it because they remembered, hey, that guy came and talked to me in that class.
Yeah.
But beyond rank, you know, position-wise, I absolutely loved being an FSO. That was probably the best time I ever had, because you're a small unit, you're running around, and you actually get to shoot guns. Well, not really shoot guns. You see the effects of the guns. and you get to call in the rounds, and you get to sit there and really show that you're, you know, that you've mastered your job. We had a big competition for fire supporters. And it was my team that won the competition because we showed the mastery of how to navigate when you're in the field, how to use a compass to navigate, how to utilize charts to put rounds on target. You know, we did the best on the physical fitness side of things. So, you know, achieving that and being able to succeed and get some recognition for hard work is one of those pieces. And, you know, it was a really fun time.
Yeah, and that validates your entire experience, too, having that sort of thing happen. I mean, it justifies everything that you've done to that point. Very interesting. Yep. And I know back when you were Major Ben Kavanaugh, I was fortunate enough to be here at Edinburgh when you received your Lieutenant Colonel promotion. And I know we've grown to be friends here at Edinburgh, and I was excited to announce that to campus, and it was an exciting day for Edinburgh. But that might necessarily have been your most proud rank. So talk about what has been your most proud rank, and just like Andrew discussed, your most proud position in the Army.
Well, I'm going to actually say it is Lieutenant Colonel.
I knew you so well.
it was because you were there, Chris. couldn't have done it without you. In the Army, you know, like if somebody makes Lieutenant Colonel, that's like your quote unquote, that's a successful career. Like they have checked all the boxes. So rank is a weird thing. If some people know what your rank is, you get treated differently. And just growing up, I didn't grow up in that type of family. It was more of let your actions speak for you. So I don't like, you know, I will first always introduce myself to somebody who doesn't know me if I'm in civilian clothes as my name, and I'll never use a title. Unless they wanted, but I would say I'm so proud of it because of, you know, the 5 years of being a major that I was just working my butt off, and I can look back at some of the accomplishments of what I did as an Iron Major. Being promoted to Lieutenant Colonel was the best reward ever for, you know, having essentially what I like to call an urban deployment to Fort Bliss, Texas for 2 years, where essentially I would wake up, go to PT, drive into the New Mexico desert, and I would stay there until dark, and I would come home when I was the S3 and the XO for our battalion out there. And that was for 2 years straight, where essentially I didn't see my family. And it was weird just training Guard and Reservists to go overseas and do route clearance missions.
Interesting.
And it was just every day. It was either out there with the training unit or validating our trainers or coming up with creative new training scenarios and running through them with the training team. And, you know, from there, then I went to ILE, which is like your major school, you know, the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth. And I, you know, did school there for a year. And then on the nights and weekends, I earned my master's while I was there. So it was still not like a take a knee kind of like, all right, I'm going to go to school till 3 o'clock and then go home and drink beer. It was, I'm going to go to school till 3, read all this doctrine, have to be able to synthesize it and report back on it the next day. Friday night, I would love nothing more to do than to go to Kansas City, but I have to go to the education center and take a college class. And then all day Saturday, I'm going to be taking a class. So that, I mean, that was a hard year, another year, hard year for my family. And then I got the reward of, you know, doing, you know, kicking butt there. And then I ended up going to Italy after that for 3 years.
Nice.
And that was hard jobs as well, you know, figuring out how to build these, you know, locations in Africa before you get there. I mean, that was just, again, long nights and many weekends lost just focusing on those problems.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I did get the reward of, you know, like to brief the general, you know, the general over all of United Forces Africa. So I got to brief, you know, the Army Africa Command General. So I briefed him a couple of times. But then the AFRICOM commander, you know, it's like the big guy. Like, if you saw him in a parking lot 100 yards away, you would
know.
Stop, lock up at the position of attention, and you'd just be like, I'm not walking over them. He's like, he's my boss's boss's boss. Like,
yeah.
He's the man. But I got the honor of, I did so well, or I didn't do so well, but I had accomplished so much as the engineer for that program that, you know, the commanding general of Army Africa just said, okay, Ben, you're going to brief, you know, the commanding general about this plan and the budget and how we're going to do it. I was like, sir, I'm
speechless.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm speechless. I'm scared. I'm sweating. I wanted to throw up. But it was all worth it. And then they opened up a new unit while I was over there called a geospatial planning cell. And that's where I got my love for drones.
Yeah, there you go.
But essentially, it's the map makers of that, you know, that combatant command. So, you know, the Army needs, you know, they need maps. Typically, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, they make the bulk of maps that we use in the Army. But if a combatant commander needs a map of an area for a mission that he's planning, the bureaucracy of a civilian, you know, led workforce of NGA is, it's, you know, it's like turning around an ocean liner.
Yeah.
It takes forever. But, you know, you get a team of 27, you know, young soldiers and you want a map of XYZ, then darn it, we're gonna make it for you.
We're gonna make it happen.
And we're gonna not stop until we do it. So to actually like try to stand that unit up was an awesome honor. And then, you know, then I get rewarded with that to come to ROTC. And I got promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. So it was just, you know, you just push through and grind through it. And the reward is what got me here today. But the key piece of it all is, you know, there's jobs that we get in the Army that they're not desirable and you don't love them. But the people who succeed are the ones who just say, I'm gonna be the best, whatever boring job officer, like when I said for camp, you know, if you go there and your job is day one reception, you gotta figure out the laundry schedule and stuff, be the best one of it you can, you know, work late, work hard, and you'll get rewarded.
Builds character too.
It does. So if you just take those, you know, the semi less desirable job positions or positions that people say, you know, aren't really maybe setting your career up for success, I would say they're wrong. I've had some of those bad jobs and I think I kicked butt at them and I had a lot of fun doing it. And, you know, I had the reward, the internal reward of, hey, I did the best I could at it and I turned in a great product and hopefully I made the Army a better place for it.
So I think we have time for one more question. You give great stories all around. It's interesting seeing the firsthand perspective of a military career, and I appreciate all the responses that you've given. Last question, a good closing is, we have two military veterans who work in higher education, one working with Title IX, one working with the next generation of second lieutenants in ROTC. All of that is somehow tied to your military experience. What has been the lasting impact of your experience in the military? How does that affect your life today, whether it's your family, your location, or your career? How has your military experience affected your life the most? Let's start with Ben.
All right. I would say, I have a real great appreciation for other cultures now. I've been to Iraq. I've been to Afghanistan. I've been to Italy. From Italy, got to travel down to Africa. So I went to 5 different countries in Africa.
And you've had some cadets that have traveled to Thailand as well.
Right.
So at least you can share the cultures that way.
And when they come back and just get to share the stories, and you just see not necessarily how similar all those cultures are, but how dissimilar America is from the rest of the world.
Interesting.
And we just have our total own spin and how we do things and look at things, and just how fast paced a life we have. Whereas around the world, they take a slower look at life, not on everything, but there are a lot of things that you would, if you were an American, you'd be like, come on,
let's go.
A restaurant. Give me the bill, I ate, I want to go get some ice cream next, and then we'll go into the movies. And, we're like on a time schedule and a time hack. If you went to lunch in this little bar that I went to in Africa or any place in Italy, they're not going to bat an eye if you sit there for 3 hours and just sip coffee and have appetizers and that's it. That's what they're there for. They're there to make sure you have a good time at their restaurant. So I really do appreciate a lot of the things that other cultures do and how they approach life. And I'm glad that I've experienced that. So now I can, sometimes when I'm just feeling stressed out or I want to have to do 50 million things and be like, all right, really? Let's just take a step back, give it the old, the Italians would just say allora, and it's like, just, all right, let's take something off the plate and, try not to stress over everything if you don't have to.
Very interesting. How about over to you, Andrew?
Thinking about it, probably the biggest thing that I've learned from being in the military that I regularly apply, we've got this thing called master resiliency training, and part of it is mindfulness. And that's kind of become one of my biggest things, is just being mindful of, what I do, how it affects others, how important being mindful of yourself and being mindful of others is to leadership. I'm constantly thinking about good leadership. What does that mean? How does it work with other people? And even if you're not actually leading, because cut line, this isn't a leading position. You're just an advocate for a system and an advocate for a process. But, what part am I playing? How does my role affect others? How can it help others? How does it, help the campus community as a whole? Just as much as when I'm sitting there as the budget officer for Center for Game Combat Team, what's my role? How do I help people? How do I, make sure my organization succeeds? And how do I, get the most out of it for not just myself, but everybody else?
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Kavanaugh and Major Andrew Matt, for joining us today on Tartan Talks. We learned a lot about leadership, about loyalty, respect, learning other cultures, and everything that goes into being a military veteran. I thank you both for taking time out of your day to speak with us here on Tartan Talks, and we appreciate everything you do for Edinburgh and for the next generation of soldiers. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
All right.